XXX GabFest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Hello, and welcome to the XXX GabFest for Thursday, February 7th, the Mrs. Carter edition. I'm Allison Benedict, managing editor of XXX, filling in for Hannah Rosen, who is briefly back on book tour this week. And I'm joined in the New York studio by Noreen Malone, staff writer at The New Republic, which just came out with a brand new redesign of its magazine and website, both of which look awesome.
Yeah, we're excited. Hey. Allison.
And in the DC studio is Slate senior editor Dan Coyes, who, among many, many other things, edits Slate's great monthly book review. Hey, Dan.
I just had a monthly redesign of my hair.
How?
Yeah.
Please tell us more.
I got a haircut.
Okay. That was less exciting. I was hoping for a mohawk or something.
No. I don't have enough hair on the top of my head.
Yeah, I was going to make a comment about that, but I decided not to. So the three things we're going to talk about this week are the woman, the singer, the life force, Beyoncé. We'll also then totally switch gears and talk about a terrific new piece in The New Yorker about Amy Bishop, a professor at the University of Alabama, Huntsville, who at the end of a staff meeting in 2010 pulled out a gun and shot her colleagues. And finally, we'll switch gears again and talk about weight loss, the myths and facts of weight loss and what we know, what we don't, and why we keep fooling ourselves. But before we get into any of that, I just want to remind or let all of our D.C. area listeners know that there are still a few tickets left for our live GabFest, which will be next week, February 13th at 6th and I in D.C. Hannah will be there, Noreen will be there, and special guest star Emily Yaffe, otherwise known as Slate's advice columnist Dear Prudence, will be there to answer your anonymous love and relationship and anything else questions. So it's going to be really fun. I'm bummed to miss it, but I hope you won't.
Anonymous in the sense that you're saying them out loud in front of an audience.
No. I mean, I have a feeling. I don't know. This is a good question, but I think they'll be passed notes.
Yes. There's a system arranged so that no one will know, you know, that you're sleeping with your cousin or whatever it is that you want to ask Dear Prudy about.
And if you
That's
don't
not
have
what I want to ask her about.
You want to ask her about your hair, right?
Right.
If you don't have your own questions, you can, you know, just gawk at other people's questions. Not that it will not be a judgmental podcast. it will be open and loving and great. So if you want tickets or get more info, check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXMag, or go to slate.com where on the left-hand rail there's a yellow event section called, I think, Up Next that will direct you to a ticket buying page. So do it and have fun. Okay, so I can't really remember a time when Beyoncé wasn't in the news, but the singer, dancer, business, and everything else woman has definitely been in the headlines a lot lately, from her much-discussed and dissected lip-synced national anthem performance at the inauguration to this past Sunday night Super Bowl halftime show, which may or may not have caused a blackout at the Superdome, to her upcoming world tour, which we now know is called the Mrs. Carter Show, Carter being the last name of her husband and father of her child, Sean Carter.
Otherwise known as Jay-Z.
Correct. Yes, thank you. And her upcoming HBO documentary, which is billed as an unvarnished look at Beyoncé, which also just happens to be directed and produced by Beyoncé. So we were watching the Super Bowl, and my 4-year-old son was transfixed watching her do her thing, and at the end turned to me and said, "Mom, she's a really good lady, isn't she?" Which I'm not entirely sure what that meant. But Noreen, you recently wrote a piece pretty much arguing the same, that Beyoncé is the perfect female icon for our time. So tell us more about that. And then, Dan, I want to hear if you're buying it.
Well, first of all, your son could be a culture critic. She is a pretty good lady. So the piece that I wrote was slightly tongue-in-cheek, but I am sort of serious about it. I argued that, especially in her most recent iteration, post having her baby, she had a baby, Blue Ivy, about a year ago, and this tour and this this inaugural appearance and the Super Bowl appearance are all part of her sort of comeback from becoming a mother. And so Beyonce is an icon for the era of having it all, right? So she's got the perfect baby. She's got the perfect marriage. Now she's got – she's always had this insanely successful career. But one thing that she in recent interviews has been purposely open about is how hard she has to work for it. And that is a major theme, I guess, of her upcoming documentary, which I admit I haven't seen. But the trailer is a lot about her seizing creative control and the difficulty involved in that. And so
seizing creative control from
Her. So not too long ago, she broke from her father as manager, you know, and in her recent albums, she sort of has moved away from tracking pop trends and towards becoming more of a soul gospel singer, which it's clear that's where her heart sort of is. But, you know, it seems like Beyonce is really making a concerted effort to say, this isn't easy for me. I know that I've worked really hard to control my image, to tightly control my image so that everything is perfect. But you should know that it's difficult for me as much as it is for you. And I think that's an image that resonates with women up and down the socioeconomic ladder. One of the things about the having it all discussion that people always say, which I think to some degree is true, is that it's like an upper middle class slash wealthy woman problem. But in fact, as we've talked about on this podcast before, in an era of more and more single motherdom, if you're not having it all, you're maybe doing it all. And so this idea that someone is juggling so many things is really resonant. And she looks like totally badass doing it in her like iguana and python leotard with her like fierce faces, and I was impressed by that halftime performance. But do you guys think I'm completely full of shit,
Dan?
I don't. No, I mean, and I don't know if you guys were hoping that I'd be like the anti Beyonce voice.
No, no,
I'm not. I'm all in.
We're hoping that you'd be honest.
Right. Oh.
Dig deep.
Shit. No, I really agree with you, Noreen. And I think that image of herself as superwoman on the outside, right, Beezus, but actually working really hard to accomplish what she's accomplishing and always feeling like at any moment it could be taken away is unbelievably resonant for basically every woman I know. I mean, every mom I know in my neighborhood, including my wife, I think puts forth an amazing front of being superwoman, right, and having everything under control. And every one of them feels underappreciated and like people don't really understand exactly how hard it is to keep everything under control and how hard it is to appear for it all to be effortless.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a pretty universal feeling among women up and down the socioeconomic strata, as you say, Noreen. And mm-hmm. So – yeah, I mean, I just love that she's revealing this, that she is showing what is underneath the beautiful facade. And I mean, I also appreciate that the facade remains completely beautiful. And I think that all of her fans also appreciate that she still looks amazing and performs amazingly and sounds great, even though this is all so much hard work, and even though all the rest of us can't look that amazing necessarily.
So I was chatting with my mother on the phone last night, and she asked what we were talking about on the Gabfest today, and I said, "Oh, Beyonce and feminism." And my mom had a really interesting comment, she sort of took a little bit of issue with Beyonce as feminist, and she said, "Well, what does Beyonce do for other people?" And I sort of stopped in my tracks, and I was like, "Yeah, like this whole Beyonce as superwoman, but telling us how hard she works, it really is a sort of like appreciate me kind of thing," which I've thought was, you know, both obvious and interesting, right? That maybe this like having it all debate, why it rubs people the wrong way, is that it's just about people saying, no, I mean, look at me, look at how hard I'm working, like appreciate everything that I am doing for you, not, you know, not what I am doing for you.
But it's bigger than that, right? Because the having it all debate also is about the way society forces people to be unappreciated.
Sure.
And so for Beyonce, for her, it's a matter of how her upbringing and the way that her father controlled her image and her music and her career for so long kept her from being appreciated. And granted, she has the advantage of millions and millions of dollars and an enormous personal staff.
Right.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you guys about. So you write in your piece, for the vast majority of those who consume Beyonce's visual hagiography, wondering how she does it is more fun than feeling as if you know how. Mm-hmm. Because in the back of all of our minds, I assume, is we know that she has, like, this massive staff and she – and who knows how much she's actually doing it all. Who knows how much she's parenting? Who knows how much she's you know, I mean, she's certainly doing the work on stage. I'm not like I'm taking that away from her, but I don't necessarily see her as reflective of, you know, Dan, your wife's having it all struggle and the, you know, women in your neighborhood. And I just wonder how much of now her opening up, and I'm saying that with finger quotes, air quotes, is more just like about this image that she's cultivating.
Well, I mean, anyone who's looking to Beyoncé for practical advice on how to run her life is got bigger problems maybe than having it all. You know, she's a pop star. Her life is just lived on a different scale.
But she's launching this website that you say is like modeled after Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop, which is supposed to be life advice.
Right. And it's life advice. Goop, I am embarrassingly eager to open Goop emails. I can't decide if I like it or hate it, and it's some combination of it. But the point of it is that about half of the things you find interesting, and you could maybe make that recipe, and you could totally read that book, but you're not going to buy the $500 cashmere sweater. So with Goop, and now with Beyoncé's Beehive, which I've also signed up for, I mean, the idea, my brainwashing is complete. The idea is that, you know, they sort of, they act like they're opening a door, letting you sort of peek into their lives. You know, it's aspirational lifestyle porn in the way that, you know, any feature in a women's magazine inviting you inside the home of an actress or movie star and talking about her diet and what she does with her kids is. But the idea that it's a little more unmediated, it's just like a letter from her to you, makes you feel like you are on speaking terms of some kind with Beyoncé, which is a purposeful thing, right? Right. She wants to connect with her fans. But that's, you know, that's not practical advice. It's another form. It's another shrine at which to worship Beyoncé.
It's marketing.
But I mean,
marketing.
I would also say it is about image, mm-hmm. but image is not valueless.
Oh, you no.
know, the image that a celebrity of her stature puts forth and the message that she sends has real impact. And it has real impact on her fans. It has real impact on society. It has a huge impact on the kids who think that she's a good lady. you know, and I think about my kids. There are plenty of ways in which people want to make Beyoncé controversial, right? They argue about the outfit she wore at the halftime show, or they argue about whether she is using the right name for her tour. But when my kids view her, they view her as a woman who sings really well, songs that they love, and sometimes she sings them with her husband. And isn't mm-hmm. that nice?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's great. Like, you know, she does sing really well. She's a great dancer. She puts on a great show. I guess where I have a little bit more hesitance is to, like, make her anything more than that, or make anyone that I don't know anything more than that.
Okay, but I don't mind using her as an example to my kids. Beyond the way that they view her, we talk to them about, well, she and her husband work together on this song, and she wrote this song, and he does the rapping on it. Or, you know, this is her album, and she made it. She is responsible for it. I think that makes an impact on them. And even though they certainly will probably not share her lifestyle or her purchasing ability.
You never know. I think that has
real value.
Well, Noreen, you sort of place her in this line of pop stars that reflect certain feminist values that do, like, that are more than just the sum of their albums.
Sure. So Loretta Lynn famously sang about the pill. Madonna was all about, you know, pushing the boundaries of sexual iconography. And Lady Gaga certainly has made it a real crusade to, you know, make everyone with whatever sexuality they have feel welcome. So Beyoncé's message, such as it is maybe a little more mainstream, right? She's not necessarily pushing against something that quite as clear. But one thing that I sort of traced through her songs that I really think is there, and especially if you look at her Super Bowl lineup of the songs that she sings, is this theme of independence through money, you know? Independent Woman, The Shoes on My Feet I Bought 'em, that song Bills, Bills, Bills. What are the other ones? There are tons. Even, you know, All the Single Ladies, If You Like It, You Should Have Put a Ring on It. That's sort of valuing your worth in, you know, hard currency terms. And I think that's interesting and maybe a little bit new and maybe particular to this sort of third wave, fourth wave, whatever wave of feminism that we're on. And it's also a little bit old-fashioned, right? There's something old-fashioned about Beyoncé. You know, she's on stage. She's in a completely fierce outfit. She's, you know, scantily clad, just doing her thing. But she's also, in a lot of her videos, she's in sort of old-fashioned noir clothing, and she's the wife making, you know, cleaning the house. And she titled her tour, as we said, the Mrs. Carter Tour. And so she's playing with the idea that you can have this traditional... You can be a sort of traditional woman and you can also be incredibly independent. And again, I think that's something that resonates particularly with young women who in some ways are more conservative than people a generation or two ahead of them.
I have a quick question for any of you guys. Are any of you guys Dolly Parton fans?
This is Chris, our producer, weighing in.
I love Dolly Parton.
A lot of the stuff you were saying about the other performers was reminding me of the way that I know Dolly Parton fans in my life talk about Dolly Parton. I don't know if that resonates at all with you.
It does. I think we could do hours on Dolly.
Dolly has been very, very careful throughout her career to really put forth this notion of financial independence and owning her own career in the same way that Beyoncé has.
I think, though, that Beyoncé is appeals to a wider swath of
Swath.
I'm from the Midwest, guys. I'm from the Midwest. Appeals to a wider swath of women than Dolly Parton does. I think, you know, the question of Beyoncé as icon for both black and white and women of all races is an interesting one, and maybe one that deserves its own segment as well. But yeah, I think just in sheer market saturation, Beyoncé has it over Dolly.
But I get what you're saying, Chris, about sort of like the line between kind of being in a way old-fashioned but then playing with sexuality. And I mean that.
And also in the sense of taking control of your career. Like I remember someone telling me this story about Dolly Parton being one of the few people who refused to sell publishing and writing rights of one of her songs to Elvis when he wanted to record it. And just like not being led
Suck
by
Elvis.
Other people around. So I don't know. Just reminded me of that.
This all just makes me really excited for the – like 2027 opening of Beyoncé Wood outside of Houston.
I bet it's coming.
I will totally go.
Okay, let's move on to our second topic, the Amy Bishop case. But before we do that, I want to thank our loyal sponsor, Audible.com, the leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information. Audible has 100,000 audiobooks and podcasts and radio shows and all sorts of great things to listen to that we can all download to our various devices, including whatever device you are listening to us on right now. For XX listeners who aren't already Audible members, you can get a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at this URL, audiblepodcast.com/XX, not XX, but just the letters XX. The book I want to recommend today is Jamie Attenberg's new novel, The Middlesteins, which relates to our final topic about weight loss, which we'll get to later. It's about the unraveling of a longtime married couple in the Chicago suburbs, and the wife in that couple is obese and constantly struggling with food. I actually have not read this book. I'm guessing you guys have, or listened to it. I'm guessing at least one of you guys have. But it's gotten terrific reviews and is at the top of my maternity leave list to read, although now I'm considering switching that to be on my listen-to list because it is narrated by none other than Molly Ringwald.
Really?
Yeah.
It's funny.
That's awesome.
Is a novelist. I read her her novel this summer.
Okay. Dan, did you like this book?
I really like Jamie Attenberg's book, yes. It's very funny. It's really sharp. It reads really easily, and I think it would actually be great out loud. I mean, it's very about voice with the different characters, and I think that having a good actress like Molly Ringwald do it would be totally enjoyable.
Okay, well, I'm psyched to read it or listen to it. Okay, so let's move on. Patrick Radden Keefe has a long feature in this week's New Yorker, I hope I'm saying his name correctly, about Amy Bishop, a neurobiologist at the University of Alabama Huntsville, who in 2010 went to a staff meeting and, as it was winding down, pulled a handgun out of her purse and shot six of her colleagues, three fatally. Bishop had earlier been denied tenure, and that was quickly pointed to as her motive, but soon after her arrest, it was revealed that she had, many years prior, actually shot and killed her 18-year-old brother, Seth, in the kitchen of the childhood home. That shooting, at the time, was deemed an accident, basically because her mother was there to witness it and said it was an accident, and Bishop was never charged, and it was also really never investigated. So most of the New Yorker piece is actually not about the University of Alabama shooting, but it's going back to this Boston suburb, Braintree, Massachusetts, where Amy and Seth grew up and where Amy shot Seth, to try to figure out what happened back then and how it relates to what happened at the university. It's an incredibly compelling read, and you should definitely all read it. And we can talk about so many aspects of it, but I want to start by asking you, Dan, if you think the case is more compelling, somehow more tragic, or harder to comprehend because Amy Bishop is a woman, a mother of four, or is gender incidental here?
I don't think it's ever incidental. I mean, just because there's such a dearth of women who engage in mass shootings like this. I mean, Amy Bishop's is, I believe, the largest mass shooting by a woman in recent history, right? I mean, there's only been only one mass shooting in the last 20 years in which more than four people were killed.
By a woman,
yes. And so it is shocking when something like this happens. It's always shocking when a mass shooting happens, right? But then we often comfort ourselves with these sort of immediate preconceived notions about how the shooter related to society. And we always almost immediately think of them as a loner or a weird person or like a mentally ill person who snaps. But we don't think of them necessarily as someone who successfully raised four children to adulthood, had, by all accounts, a happy, solid marriage, or at least a marriage that had lasted, and who held down a job for years and years and years. I mean, people thought she was like weird and she rang people's alarm bells, but the very normalcy of her life and tied up in that normalcy is her state as a wife and mom. Does make this, I think, a more shocking case.
Right. And she didn't ring people's alarm bells in a mass killer kind of way.
No.
It just described her as high strung, like one of those moms who was always obsessing about organic food, which I found to be a sort of funny detail.
Right. Like every mom. Oh, my God.
Right. Exactly.
But does it not ring bells because she's a woman? I went back and there was this piece in The New Yorker in 1998, a review of a couple of books about violent women. And it starts off by citing the case of Mary Beth Tinning, who was a mother who back in the 60s and 70s lost nine of her children to various illnesses and accidents. And it took the ninth death for police to finally investigate Mary Beth. And The New Yorker wrote about this case, again, in reviewing these two books about violent women, and summed it up by saying that Mary Beth's children were the victims of one of the most stubborn aspects of male chauvinism, which is sex bias in the detection of crime. And I wonder if that's a reason why Bishop's original case wasn't investigated, and also why we say, you know, these things about her didn't set off alarm bells. Because in other ways, she does fit some of the mold. Like she, like James Holmes, is like a frustrated academic. Not that all frustrated academics are
frustrated
shooting people.
Frustrated academics and people who like organic food are
right.
All being profiled right,
right
now.
Do we overlook women? Do we pathologize them or excuse them somehow because they're, you know, experiencing postpartum, they're hormonal, I don't, you know.
Well, so one of the things that was most interesting to me about this article was that in many ways it wasn't about Amy, it was about her mother. And the, you know, the implication of the article was that the mother had sort of covered up the real facts of the event, which by the end of the article, which you all should read, even though I'm about to tell you how it ends, it really, really is worth reading. It's well-constructed and full of fascinating details. But so by the end, you are meant to think that Amy, who had gotten in an argument with her father, meant to aim the gun at her dad. One of the supporting details is that after she shot her brother, she sort of reloaded. And so you're meant to think that the mother, who is very good friends with the police chief, sort of arranged that the daughter not be prosecuted. And to me, that was the real drama of the piece, right? This idea of a mother's love being greater than justice. And I think in many of the cases that you cited, the one of the woman who killed her 9 kids, and certainly Casey Anthony, who was not found guilty, but who, you know, many people on cable news and elsewhere still consider guilty. I think the shocking thing is that these women would have violated this incredible bond between mother and child in such an awful way as to kill them. And so we can understand when a mother covers up her daughter's murder of someone else, even one of her other children, allegedly. But we can't understand a mother who would kill her own children.
Right. It's the almost quotes that
– oh, go ahead, Dan.
Oh, right. The quotes that Patrick gets from people in Braintree, right, who basically say, you know, I don't know why Amy killed Seth, and I'm glad that Judy, Amy's mom, never told me because that's what a mother should do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it was my kid, I would do the exact same thing. And we should note here that Patrick is a one-time Slate writer. He was our longtime contributor to the Slate Mad Men TV Club, but until we unfortunately lost him to The New Yorker. But thankfully, he is producing amazing stuff like this. But yes, this notion that a mother in different ways is most clearly aware of what is going on with her children and will protect them as fiercely as she can up to possibly covering up certain aspects of her own son's death.
And you almost don't get the sense that she's lying. I mean, you feel as though she has so thoroughly convinced herself of this that she doesn't know if she's lying. We don't know if she's lying. But
right. Patrick totally. Doesn't know if
right.
she's lying.
Right.
I mean,
totally.
Part of the piece is his uncertainty. And
right.
the piece ends on this amazing note of him basically confronting her and her husband with this theory he has. And it is presented as only a theory. And maybe you believe it in reading or you don't about Amy wanting initially to kill her father, or at least to threaten him with a gun. And he presents this to her parents in their house in Massachusetts, and the mom just flat out denies it and then stares at him so long that he is forced to turn away in discomfort and he can't take it anymore. And I found that a really moving moment about the way that writers ferret out mysteries and try to ferret out mysteries, but are always – you're always subject to – the memories and the willingness to speak of the people that you're talking to. And the real answer to this is that we will never actually know what happened with Seth, just as we will never actually know why she shot those people in Huntsville. And I found that really moving and also sort of unbearable in a way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One thing that is not in any way sort of directly referenced, but the piece itself is called A Loaded Gun. And when Bishop's husband calls her mother to tell her that Amy had been arrested for shooting her colleagues. The mother replied, "You had a gun in the house?" So although the piece itself is not trying to tie itself directly to Newtown or the gun control debate, I did think about it as I was reading it. Did that strike you guys as well?
Absolutely. And I'm sure that was a purposeful choice on behalf of the editor and the writer as well. But I don't think, you know, as much as that was a theme, it was also guns don't kill people, people kill people. It was sort of equal-handed in both of those two things. Guns kill people if you have them in the house,
right.
You know?
Right. The two incidents are sort of two different arguments about gun control, right?
Right.
The killing of Seth never happens if that gun is not in the house. The dad bought the gun for protection. He kept the gun in his closet and the shells on his dresser. And so kids could get at them. But that killing that day never happens if that gun isn't there.
Unless we think she is a killer.
And she wasn't super young when this incident happened, right? Well, she was
in college.
She was 21.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
she could have bought her own, which is incidentally.
Right, but she didn't. I mean, but she didn't have to. Mm-hmm. And I guess the point in all of these cases is when there's a gun in the house, it becomes unbelievably more likely that someone in that house gets killed. By
Absolutely.
Being shot by that gun.
Absolutely.
And so whether the killing was an accident or whether she meant to kill someone else that day but maybe would have gotten over it or whether she might have eventually plotted to murder her father or brother in some other more horrible way, it wouldn't have happened that day. And so maybe it never would have happened at all. Whereas the Huntsville case is a totally different argument about gun control because she had access to that gun. She got it legally and there's no doubt that even if she hadn't owned that gun, she would have found a way to get a gun and go into that faculty meeting and kill people. There's no sense you get that the easy availability of that gun necessarily was the reason that happened.
Actually, I'm not sure that's true because it was her husband's gun, right? If there had been a background check of her, I guess nothing would have come up because the case was closed and never
– There was no charges were ever filed.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true. Okay, well, we highly recommend you read this piece, and besides being bringing up really interesting issues of gender and violence and guns, it is just, as Noreen said, a terrific piece of magazine journalism. So our final topic is weight loss, something we can all probably weigh in on. No pun intended.
Oh.
That really wasn't a pun intended. It just came out. There was a new article published late last week in the New England Journal of Medicine, in which David B. Allison, the director of the Nutrition Research Obesity Center at the University of Alabama, but a different one at Birmingham, and his colleagues present 7 myths and 6 unconfirmed presumptions about obesity and also 9 facts about weight loss that all add up to it's really, really, really hard to lose weight. There's a great piece in the New York Times, the Well blog, summing up these myths and facts and quoting other experts in the field, basically saying, oh my God, thank you to this David guy for pointing out all of the diet bullshit. But I can't help but think that so much of this we already know, that way, way, way back in some tiny corner of our brains, we know this and we just do an incredible job of kidding ourselves about what it takes to lose weight. So
it was pretty amazing, though, to read that some of the like basic assumptions that I think all of us have always had about weight loss have just like never been researched in actual clinical trials.
Well, so that's what I wanted to ask. Did anything in this actually surprise you?
Yes, just like the sort of like haphazardness of scientific research and how it's never like directed, and it's directed by the marketplace. But even in this case, that's failed because I would assume that weight loss research is an unbelievably lucrative field of research, right? Like
right.
Everyone cares about it. Diet medications, if they're ever approved, do really, really well. And so the fact that no one has ever had a clinical trial to actually prove that, for example, weighing yourself every day is a useful way to help take weight off or keep it off, that's crazy. No one's ever done that study.
And yet I had the feeling when reading this, like, yep, another weight loss article that tells me that I am surprised by what I know and yet at the same time not surprised by what I don't know. And there's a reason we keep reading them over and over again. And I suppose this is about why we keep reading them over and over again, because we don't know anything for sure. But, this isn't going to change the way we talk about weight loss or how often we talk about weight loss. It's not going to change the number of articles that appear in the New York Times and in women's magazines and in Slate, just because it's probably not going to change the percentage of clinical trials versus just market-directed studies. It's just another one that we're going to read. And for a week, we're going to be like, okay, yeah, that was interesting. And then next week, we're going to read something about going gluten-free and we're going to do that.
Is that your presumption that these studies don't happen basically because that the money is in the market and that the money is there to help companies make money off of our obsession with weight loss?
The money is in the market, but also people love, and people, myself included, love reading these articles that promise a magic bullet, right? And there's something about the feeling that if you can just figure out this one thing to change and you sort of have this sense of control, like, okay, I'm going to eat 5 avocados a day and then I'm going to be skinny. Like, you know, there's something very seductive about having a blueprint and just have being armed with knowledge, right, about something so mysterious as your body that you don't feel like you have control over. And so we are sort of addicted to reading these articles that offer us these blueprints and these ways forward and, you know, just these mantras to follow.
So, Dan, I often think that reading these articles must, like, fire the same, you know, sensors in our brain, the same receptors in our brain that would be activated by us magically looking into a mirror and seeing ourselves skinny.
That's interesting.
I mean, and watching The Biggest Loser and having January 1st happen.
Yeah, no, but I think there's something different about, like, January 1st happens and there's this sense of guilt or just obligation, right? Or, like, you know, a wedding is coming up and you know you're being photographed and there's a sense of...
But it's possibility.
That's possibility. This is literally a blueprint. And that's what I like about reading them is just, like, you know, it's like solving a puzzle, right? There's an empty piece in my life, and those 5 avocados are it. And once I put them in, it's wouldn't that be a great diet, by the way? 5 avocados a day to skinniness?
No, horrible. Who wants
it doesn't
to
work,
like that?
You guys.
Okay, so Dan, you're actually, I don't know if you're are you still Dan? Is an incredibly attractive man, but he also recently lost a whole bunch of weight on a real diet plan.
I did.
Which you can tell our listeners about if you want to. And also, I'm just curious if while you were doing it, you felt foolish? Like, no. I mean, it was working, but
yes,
you had said to me that,
like an idiot.
The whole time, you had said, you wrote to us actually in an email that, like, you know, basically what you were doing is, like, based on pseudoscience and are you going to keep it off? You know, very like, we hope that you do. And yes, you are, Dan, but.
But
maybe
there's no
in the
way
back
I
of
will.
Your head you don't think you
right.
will. So
right, no, it's and that's what, I mean, this is what I think is amazing about weight loss is that the only way to do it probably is to buy into something, and mm-hmm. maybe it's 5 avocados if 5 avocados actually works. Maybe it's the
patent pseudo, pending.
Right. Maybe it's pomegranates. maybe it's like marathon training, or maybe it's the pseudoscientific. Actual money-making diet that I signed on to, whose name I'm not going to say because I hate them, but they worked. They worked. I hate them, and I hated myself the whole time I was doing this diet and eating 5 bars a day and 1 lean and green meal. And I felt so ridiculous when I actually went into this place every week and talked to, like, chipper weight loss associates who would weigh me and take my metabolic rate with a thing they put over my nose. And it was all bullshit, but it worked. It worked and I lost a lot of weight, but I never stopped feeling stupid.
I think that's a very – I'm just going to paint with a broad brush here. I think that's a very male response to dieting. I mean, certainly I think women feel ridiculous dieting too, but I think there's also – you can sort of bond with people over it. A few years ago, I did the South Beach diet for like 2 weeks. And now anytime someone talks about the South Beach diet, I sort of have this sisterhood with them. And
that's how I feel about SoulCycle.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, I think there's just a different response. And maybe it's because women are expected to diet and you feel silly because men are not expected to care or something. But I have never felt silly while on a diet. I've felt virtuous.
Well, certainly that's the benefit. I think that's what Weight Watchers is pushing in all those Weight Watchers for Men ads, right? That it's mm-hmm. okay for men to diet. And it is true that being on this diet that I was on, which was not Weight Watchers, because Weight Watchers is way too easy to game, man. I can cheat Weight Watchers like nobody's business. but like being on this diet, I was able to bond with my wife, who was also on the diet. And so we would just basically spend all day and all night commiserating over email and then in person about how awful everything was and how stupid we felt.
Yeah.
But it's true that – so, for example, she is a woman. So she has been – I mean, she has been on like actual diets with names way more than I have in my life because it is never really something that concerned me or was an issue to me until I just got really fucking fat. And I do think that that is a somewhat male response. But I do also think that it's not only male and it is particularly endemic to people who already have a problem like with this notion of buying into something that is potentially unreal, right? So it's basically about faith. Mm-hmm. I already have a problem in my life about faith. I have a real issue with professing faith in things and taking things at face value or for granted. And so when I come across this diet with its claims that their magic $3 granola bars can cause me to lose weight, even though it's true because following these rules unbelievably severely restricted my calorie count, it still just made me angry that in a way that I think is a lot of people would be made angry by being forced to do something that goes against your unwillingness to believe in fake science or fake inspiration or fake whatever.
How did you feel when that study came out about BMI actually not being what was it that like people
you don't
who are,
live longer by having a lower BMI?
Right. It's people who are somewhat overweight, according to this one study, actually live longer than people who are within the normal BMI range.
Which is just like, what?
Well, the good news is 45 pounds lost later, I am now just slightly overweight. So I'm in perfect shape.
Good job.
You know, I wonder, Dan, there's something about being pushed out of your comfort zone, which is a very exercise guru thing to say. But you know, you're probably someone who thinks that just sort of mindfulness and eating a certain amount of balanced veggies and fruits is the way to go, right? That's within your comfort zone, but that wasn't helping you lose weight and you had to do something that was so totally against your nature that you found ridiculous. And then, you know, you had to actually fight with your body, which is what these diets let you do. They give you armor to fight with your body.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
And one of the myths, actually, that is in the study is that, like, you know, that we think being reasonable is one of the ways to actually lose weight. And one of the myths was it's a myth to set a realistic goal to lose a modest amount, and that people who are too ambitious will get frustrated and give up. And that this guy or these researchers saying that's actually not proven.
Yeah, that
it's
was
not true. Maybe like you do need to set some like crazy, ridiculous goal.
That was frustrating.
Yeah.
Right.
I didn't like this article.
All these myths, like one of the myths on the list, slow and steady is the way to lose. If you lose weight too fast, you'll lose less in the long run. That's not true. Slow and steady just made me gain a pound a month.
Okay, on that note, let's move on to our endorsements of the week. Noreen.
This has nothing to do at all with themes of double X, but I've been reading The Feminine Mystique, and so for work purposes, and so I've been trying to avoid all lady content otherwise because it's just so much gender. So I've been reading a very good book, a collection of Mark Jacobson's work for New York Magazine called American Gangster, including the title essay there was a movie by that name a few years ago, and it's based off of this article. And he's just a really good
music by Mr. Beyonce.
Yeah, music. I think so. Yeah. but yeah, he's a really good sort of old fashioned, you know, he came up through the Village Voice and as did Allison, actually. And one of the pieces in it is sort of a takedown of the end of the Village Voice as we knew it or as he knew it. And it's just if you like magazine journalism inflected with 70s style grit in New York, this is the collection to read.
That's a great recommendation. Dan.
Inspired by our Beyonce conversation and particularly Noreen's discussion of the way that her music celebrates financial independence, I want to recommend an old song by Laura Lee called Woman's Love Rights. It is a great old R&B song, which is a sort of a bill of rights for women in relationships, which includes the priceless advice. One of the things that you should always demand from your man is money he can't claim in the bank in your own name.
Holler. Okay, my recommendation is related to nothing. It's just something I watched this weekend. Sound City, which is a documentary about a legendary LA music studio called Sound City. And it's directed by Dave Grohl. He of Nirvana, Foo Fighters, everything else fame. And it's a pretty conventional documentary. I mean, it will not blow your mind aesthetically, but it's really, you know, I love those conventional music docs. And It's got Tom Petty and Mick Fleetwood and Rick Springfield. And it's both the story of this studio, which is really fun to hear, you know, Neil Young tell all of his stories, and also the story of what put the studio out of business, which is basically the switch from analog to digital recording. So it's pretty nostalgic, and it does a good job at convincing you that you should be too. And
good thing we record these podcasts on enormous reel-to-reels.
Right, right. And I think it's I watch it on demand. It's one of those like released in all venues at the same time thing. So check it out. And that is it. So please visit our XX Facebook page and let us know what you thought of today's show and what you'd like us to talk about in future podcasts. Thanks to Chris Wade for producing this podcast, and also to Andy Bowers, executive producer of All Slate Podcasts, and to Dan for joining us. Thanks so much, Dan.
My pleasure.
Talk to you guys in a few weeks. Bye.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.